Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly from The Guardian. I'm producer Jason Phipps, and this week's podcast is a feature-length interview with Pedro G. Ferreira, professor of astrophysics at the University of Oxford and author of a new book, The Perfect Theory, a biography of general relativity.
It's this treasure trove. You just go in and you find all these amazing things, the expanding universe, the black holes, the recently discovered gravitational wave.
Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample met with Pedro to discuss his deep passion for Einstein's theory and its importance to physics. Not least because on the day we recorded this interview, researchers at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics announced that they had observed indirect evidence of primordial gravitational waves, which Einstein's theory of general relativity had predicted back in 1916. And so a perfect time to revisit what Pedro Ferreira calls the perfect theory.
Your book tells the story of Einstein's theory of general relativity. What are you hoping it will achieve?
I would like people to love general relativity as much as I do. I've said this before, I'm a bit of a general relativity groupie. I've always, from the moment I learnt it, I've always liked to know what happened, what's going on, even though for periods of my professional life I didn't work on it. It's this bizarre feeling that one has towards general relativity. One loves it, and I'd like people to feel the same.
You're going to have to tell us then, from the start, what is the difference between general relativity and Einstein's other theory there, special relativity?
So this is going to be a little bit long-winded, but I'll try not to make it too long-winded. When Einstein came into the game, when Einstein started doing physics in the early 20th century, there was a slight disjunct between the way people understood light and the way that people understood everything else, like the motion of trains or billiard balls. And he figured out a way of bringing them all together. And one of the results from that was that, for example, there was a maximum speed at which things could move, which is the speed of light. But he unified mechanics and electromagnetism in one beautiful framework. That's special relativity. In 1907, he realized that gravity didn't fit into it. Well, he knew that gravity didn't fit into it, and he decided to figure out how he would put in the force of gravity. Force of gravity, is the way people understood it, is that it's an action at a distance. It's instantaneous. It doesn't travel at the speed of light. So general relativity is bringing special relativity and the gravity together.
As a cosmologist, you must deal with a stack of equations. Why focus on this one? Why do you think it's perfect?
I think it's perfect for a number of reasons. First of all, this is the equation that led to us figuring out that the universe was expanding. It led us to understand an evolving universe. It's perfect because it's been around for almost 100 years. And even though people have attempted to change it and modify it, I myself over the last 5 years have been trying to figure out how we could test deviations from it. It just, holds firm. And finally, it's this treasure trove. You just go in and you find all these amazing things, the expanding universe, the black holes, the recently discovered gravitational waves.
Can you describe the equation to me? I mean, I'm only asking because everyone will know E equals mc squared from special relativity. And I'm wondering if general relativity is as simple as elegant, or is this an equation with a zillion terms that none of us will understand?
So there's a trick in general relativity and in the equation. The equations are known as the Einstein field equations. The simplest way of saying it is that the geometry of space-time is equal to the energy of stuff in it. In other words, if you put stuff in space-time, it'll change the geometry of space-time. So in the most abstract way, that's what the equation is. But then if you look at it, it's incredibly simple. I'll just say it. It's g alpha beta equals 8 pi g t alpha beta. It's an incredibly simple thing to say, a little bit more complex than E equals mc squared, but a simple thing to say. The problem is that the notation packs in a huge amount of information. And actually, it's an incredibly dense, tangled set of equations, which are very difficult to solve. That's why we're still solving them now. But it does, I think that the thing about it is it holds much, much, much more information and predicts much, much more than E equals MC squared.
Was the concept of space-time around before this equation?
The concept of space-time was around. The idea of special relativity in bringing space and time together into one unified thing was very much around it. It was even around before special relativity, but Einstein was the guy who really firmed it up. The idea of this dynamic space-time, this thing that is malleable and changes, this living entity, I think really arises with general relativity.
Tell us about its genesis. Was general relativity a natural step for physicists at that time, at the first decade or so of the 20th century?
I don't think so. I think it's one of those cases, and I'm sure historians of science will come up with proof that it isn't, but in my view, this is one of those cases where this guy, Einstein, sits down and tries to solve a problem. He goes on this trek trying to bring gravity together with special relativity. He starts in 1907. He has this amazing insight that if someone is falling down in a gravitational field, they won't feel that gravitational field, which means that being accelerated is somehow related to gravity. But then he hits this block. He doesn't know how to formulate it. And it takes this help from a friend, Marcel Grossman, and a real effort to figure out that he's got to rethink of the whole thing in terms of geometry. In my book, I say that it's a bit like learning Sanskrit and then writing a novel from scratch. And that I think that's such an amazing step. I don't see other people doing this at the time. Again, I can be proved wrong, but I don't think I really do think it's a unique step.
Did he develop new mathematics to arrive at this equation, or was it actually just an application of standard existing maths to get to something so new?
It was an application of existing maths. I don't know if I would call it standard, even though probably for some mathematicians it was standard. It was quite an esoteric form of mathematics. It was not what was known as Riemannian geometry, the geometry of surfaces which aren't, or of spaces which aren't Euclidean, which aren't flat, the geometry that we learn in high school.
Tell me about how you can have space-time not being flat. I think a lot of people struggle with this, with something that they will think of space as being three-dimensional, what it means for that to be flat or curved. How can you have a 3D space that's curved?
So you'll have to indulge me by letting me go down one dimension. And so if you think of a sheet of paper on the table and you draw stuff on it, that's flat. And, you draw your triangles and the angles add up to 180 degrees, etc., etc. But now imagine that you're doing the same thing sketching on the surface of a ball. All these rules of geometry are different. For example, if you draw two parallel lines or lines that look parallel at one point, they can intersect further along. So these two surfaces have very different geometry. Now you can imagine doing that in any dimensions, in particular in three dimensions. You can draw triangles in any dimensions, and you'll come up against the same problem that, for example, in a flat geometry, angles will in a three-dimensional Euclidean geometry, the angles add up to 180 degrees, but in a three-dimensional hyperspherical geometry, you sum up the angles and they're greater than 180 degrees.
So when this equation landed, when Einstein published, how was it received by other physicists, but also by Einstein himself?
Einstein thought he'd nailed it, which is great. There were a few mathematicians who were very into it. There were some physicists who were fascinated by it. And in particular, there was an astronomer in England called Arthur Eddington, who was very intrigued by this stuff that Einstein was doing, and intrigued because it meant with this mathematics, this bizarre mathematics, you could actually make predictions of observations. It turns out that Eddington years later, well, a few years later, 4 years later, in 1919, went out and made a measurement, and he found he in some sense proved that Einstein was right.
That was the expedition to the island. I remember there was a New York Times piece written after that, which had something like a four-deck headline, and one of them was "Stars Agog in the Heavens" or something, and one underneath, "Scientists Agog as Stars Shift in the Heavens" or something like that, and then underneath that it was "No Need to Worry, Everything's Okay." I mean, it was a fascinating piece actually, because it tried to describe something that the writer and many other people wouldn't understand, and I think even accepted that in the story by saying, "Well, I can't explain this to you, but it seems to be a big deal." And I wonder if Eddington's test was the first confirmation and whether people then accepted general relativity much more after that, if people were skeptical of it beforehand.
It's interesting. So Einstein, I mean, Einstein had a post-diction. When he came up with this theory, he explained something that had been unexplained with Newtonian gravity, with the old school gravity, which was the motion of Mercury. There were these anomalies that Mercury's orbit seemed to rotate slightly, very, very small amount every... And he was able to explain it through general relativity, but this was the first prediction. And when Eddington announces his results at a meeting at the Royal Astronomical Society, and the next day it's the London Times, and then the following day it's the New York Times, and Einstein just becomes this superstar. I mean, it's funny that things happen so quickly then. It reminds me a little bit of what happened on Monday, the 17th of March, with the announcement of the discovery of gravitational waves by this experiment in Harvard. Well, in that case, things were even announced before in the press. But, you know, things were happening pretty quickly then.
Let's just go over what fresh understanding the equation brought. I mean, did it just sort of wrap up and explain how gravity seemed to work, or did it go further and give a deeper insight into nature?
The wonderful thing about these equations was that, first of all, it was a very clear way of understanding how gravity worked, and how it worked in some sense in a similar way to, for example, the electromagnetic field, radio waves, things like that. But I think the great thing about it was there was this equation, and then you could start mining it. You could start seeing what it meant. And you know, as we know, over the first 10 years, the expansion of the universe was predicted, something that no one had a clue was going on. The discovery of black holes, even though they wouldn't call it black holes, and they didn't realize that what was going on, those bizarre effects that appear in black holes were there. I mean, all this stuff was discovered in the first 10 years, 10, 15 years. So it really brought new stuff, a lot of new stuff.
So a lot of the implications of general relativity were realized fairly rapidly.
I call it the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
The first calculations where you assume, you simplify a lot, you find these amazing results, and they're real. You know, you then look out, and years later you realize that they're out there.
So just to get to the really simple thing that people will want to take away or will probably know already, you were saying earlier how the equation will talk about how the amount of energy in a volume of space will influence its curvature. And so is it what is the relationship there? Is it just that curvature increases with energy density, and curvature doesn't give you any kind of directional information? Curvature could be all sorts of things. So what describes the type of curvature, the direction of the curvature and what have you?
So I mean, it's basically what you're saying. Energy density and even pressure will warp space-time and will bend it in certain ways. And depending on how the energy density is distributed, it'll warp it in various ways. So, for example, if you put a blob of stuff in the middle of space-time, I mean, there's the classical analogy, which I still think is useful, which is the rubber sheet with some weight in it. It'll create a dip. And then you throw something onto that rubber sheet of marble, and it'll coast along this dip, this crater, and it'll curve. It'll curve because it'll feel the curvature of this, you know, this rubber sheet, i.e. space-time. So it is that curvature. There's a way that the American physicist John Wheeler would say it, which is along the lines of stuff tells space how to bend, and space tells stuff how to move. And, you know, it's just the simplest way of understanding how it works.
But if I have two volumes of space, okay, and one has more energy in it than the other, is space in the more energy-rich one, if you like, curved more inwards or concave or convex? Or what can I say about how the curvature differs?
So the problem with the language that you're using, and it's my fault, is you're thinking in terms of two-dimensional. But let's think of that. If you've got more stuff, if you've got stuff of the same type and you have more of that stuff in one place than in another, then space will be more curved. And it's better to think of what that curvature does to things, right? It means that things that go through there, their paths will be more deflected when there's more stuff around than in places where you've got less stuff, which is kind of what you expect if it's supposed to lead to gravity.
We get emails when we write stories about gravity quite a lot of the time saying, why are you talking about a gravitational force? There is no force of gravity. And the point being that if gravity is a kind of an effect caused by curvature of space, then maybe we are wrong to talk about a gravitational force. Can you clear this up for me?
Well, yeah, look, yes, you can't really talk about a force of gravity, except I think it's an incredibly useful way for thinking about it, first of all. Second, if you sit down and you write the equations of motion of stuff in this curved space-time, you could write it in a way that it looks like they're being affected by a force. So I'm not hugely sympathetic to that kind of pedantry. I mean, I think it's absolutely fine to call it a force.
As a shorthand, we can get away with it, perhaps.
Exactly.
Okay. You were just talking about how a lot of the low-hanging fruit was grabbed by scientists when this equation first came out. But you also describe, I think, in the book, that there was really a lag. And I wonder whether, I think you say that was because quantum theory came along and maybe stole the show. Can you just take us through what happened there?
So the fascinating thing is, you know, for the first 10, 15 years, all this stuff goes on. You know, it's the low-hanging fruit and all these discoveries. And then you enter the 1930s. And, you know, roughly the timescale is like 25 years. And a number of things happened. First of all, general relativity's younger sister, quantum physics, is discovered in the late 20s. And that's just this phenomenal breakthrough. And it's phenomenal for a number of reasons. First of all, it predicts stuff that you can go away and test in a laboratory, right? It's just a really great theory to work with because you can do stuff with it. And then you can actually do stuff with it. In other words, you can build new technologies. And of course, the archetypal, the big, terrible one is the atom bomb. So it just dominated, you know, it sucked up all the intellectual life in physics and focused it on, you know, it took it away from general relativity. General relativity was more esoteric, you know, it could explain this phenomenon as out in the heavens, but it wasn't very applicable. But then there's other more sinister things that happen. One is the rise of the Deutsche Physik in Germany and the evisceration of physics with removing Jewish physicists from academia, the Stalinist materialist philosophers that considered Einsteinianism as reactionary and idealistic, the pragmatism in US science, it just became this, okay, it's right, but so what? It's not that useful. And Einstein himself, you know, went down a route in which he became, you know, he worked on his own bizarre unified theories, and he wasn't the best advocate for general relativity.
Didn't he struggle with some of the implications of it as well, though?
That's the most bizarre thing, is on the one hand, he went down this route of trying to come up with very esoteric and wrong mathematical theories, which would be an extension of general relativity, but he also found it hard to stomach some of the predictions, mathematical predictions from general relativity, and accept them as real, like, you know, black holes or an expanding universe or even gravitational waves.
There was a resurgence of interest, though, in general relativity. And how did that come about?
That came about for a number of reasons. First of all, radio astronomy came to the fore in the 1950s and started finding all these very bright, distant objects which had to be very massive, and they needed to be explained somehow in strong gravity. Because for bizarre reasons, the American industry thought, well, quantum physics has done so much for us. I wonder if general relativity can be used to build anti-gravity machines. And so for about 10 years, they dumped a lot of money into general relativity research. But I think the main reason is the rise of these charismatic people, characters, in the Soviet Union, in the US, in England, and other countries that really became fascinated with the problems of general relativity and just brought in these hordes of brilliant students, people like Stephen Hawking and Martin Rees, to work on it.
John Wheeler comes in as well, and he's probably one of my favourite physicists of all time. I mean, what was his contribution?
He was fantastic, right? So there was this problem with black holes, these solutions that were found to Einstein's equation very early on, and they have these bizarre properties that they're right at the centre, they're infinite. And physicists don't like infinity because they feel that theories break down. And so he thought, this can't be right. And so he thought, I've got to solve this problem. So to do that, he had to learn general relativity. And to do that, he had to teach general relativity. And he started to learn it and teach it. He was very creative. And he would see there were all these amazing things that you might be able to do with general relativity. Slowly and surely, he sucked in these students. He was at Princeton to work with him. And his contribution was really to create, or I wouldn't say create, but energize a particular strand of general relativity in the US.
you talk to a lot of physicists about a lot of particle physicists, they'll talk about the standard model of particle physics developed in the 70s, where you're trying to describe all the different particle types that are known and how they interact with each other. And that standard model doesn't include gravity. Why is that?
So gravity, I mean, those equations, the Einstein field equations, you know, the perfect theory, those perfect equations are incredibly tangled. They're a real mess. And so anything that you try to do feeds back on itself. And as a result, if you try and apply the methods that have been so successful in particle physics to gravity, they just don't work. If you have an infinity, it just gets worse. You can't get rid of that infinity. And so that's, you know, that's at the core of trying to, you know, it's just very nonlinear, very tangled, and space-time itself is part of the whole thing.
There's also this sort of unresolved issue of, the huge one probably, of marrying general relativity with quantum theory. And does that suggest that there's something, a grander equation underneath both of those, and that those quantum physics and general relativity are sort of equations that are applicable only over certain sort of scales?
I think that's exactly the way to think about it, that one would, you know, to marry them together, one can take a conservative view that it may be possible to make general relativity and find a way of bringing them together. But over the years and over the decades, people have started to realize that they have to question some of the most fundamental assumptions that go into each. And one of the things that different groups seem to be converging to is that our description of space-time is much more complicated than we thought. It's not the smooth rubber sheet. It's something atomized. It's like water. If you look at it very closely, it's made up of elements. But it's just such a difficult problem that at the moment these are just words.
And is that something that is beyond sort of our technology, if you like, at the moment to test, or to those ideas, are they actually coming up with, you know, testable hypotheses?
There are some ideas of how to test these kind of things by looking at very distant bursts of light and seeing how photons that propagate towards us are affected by the fabric of space-time. But in my mind, I think at the moment the challenges are almost conceptual and mathematical, and they're very difficult, and I think it's a fantastic challenge.
Last week we learned about the first possible detection of gravitational waves. How big a deal is that?
I think that's a huge deal. So, I mean, I have to put it into context. It's Einstein, shortly after he came up with this theory, he worked out that space-time would shimmer. If you kick it or if you have something, it'll send out ripples like on the surface of a pond, you know, like sound waves. These are the gravitational waves. So it was a prediction. This is the first time they've been seen directly. And I would really insist that I think it's a direct detection. Basically, it's this idea that you look at this very faint light, relic light, left over from the early universe, and you can see this unique imprint on it, which can only come from gravitational waves. It's a bit like when you look for dark matter and you look at these big blocks of stuff. There are some signatures that can only come from dark matter. So this is exactly the analogy, right? The relic light is this massive detector. But the other aspect of it is, it's just, again, it's the evolving universe, which was a prediction from Einstein. So we're looking back at the first instances in time. It's, you know, one number that people throw up is we're looking at 10 to the minus 33 seconds after the beginning, which is a zero with a dot followed by 32 zeros and then a one. So really, really early times. I mean, if it's correct, and we're all qualifying this statement, if it's correct, if it isn't, you know, if there isn't something which is mimicking this, then it's huge.
So just a bit more on the detail on this. The gravitational waves that were detected by Harvard, what was the kick to space-time that produced the ripples they're detecting? And then what is the actual signature they are seeing? Because it's something to do with polarization of light.
Yes. So basically you have, at very early times, you've got a lot going on. It's, you know, it's a mess. It's hugely, you know, it's very energetic. Lots of stuff is going on. It's not surprising that you'll generate these, you know, ripples in space-time. Those are the ripples that you're looking at. And they propagate through. Meanwhile, the universe is expanding and it's cooling. And at some point, the universe undergoes a transition where it goes from this hot plasma of electrons and protons into just this neutral space. And at this transition, we'll emit a lot of light, a bit like the surface of the sun, and it'll be polarized. What these gravitational waves do is they inject a particular twist to this polarization that nothing else can inject. It really is only these gravitational waves. at Harvard, they've detected this slight twist to the polarization.
And you're convinced that they're right?
I really want them to be right. I mean, you know, we've been discussing this since they made their announcement. And, you know, you look at the data, and on the one hand, it looks fantastic. On the other hand, there are some points that make us all worry that there's some systematic effect that hasn't been properly taken into account. So we're all saying, if it's correct, it's huge. But we're all saying, if it's correct.
Shouldn't it have been seen by one of the other detectors out there, though, as well?
It's now is the time when it would be seen. Right. So we're reaching the level of sensitivity and, you know, someone's got to see it first.
Does it mean anything for our picture of the universe, or is this really a confirmation of a picture you already had?
Does it mean it's an interesting question. I think the funny thing is we all believe gravitational waves were out there. Right. It's a bit like we all believe the Higgs was out there. And so, you know, we found the Higgs. Same thing about gravitational waves, which doesn't remove the fact that it's a huge discovery that, we've actually seen it. Does it tell us something about the early universe? Well, one theory, the most successful theory, some people say the only theory that can explain the early universe, is something called inflation, where the universe expanded, accelerated at very early times. What this tells us is what kinds of theories of inflation would be acceptable. I don't think it really confirms or disproves the theory of inflation, but it singles out particular models of inflation which are good.
General relativity is nearly 100 years old now. Do you think many people out there understand it?
I think there are two levels. There's the superficial level, which is geometry, space-time is warped with stuff in it. I think everyone understands that.
Do you mean everyone in physics?
I think everyone, to some extent. It's such, you know, it's just part of popular culture, right? You know, we talk about falling into a black hole. There are all these things which are very visual. I think it's not, if you know physics and mathematics, it's not difficult to understand. I think people still are a little bit scared of the mathematics. But the way that a lot of us teach this at university is to try and minimize the impact of the mathematics and just show that actually you can learn it with a modicum of mathematics. And so I think more people should understand it than they do. And if they don't, it's because they're freaking out about the mathematics.
You think physicists know all they need to know about general relativity, or do you think that equation has some surprises?
I think it's still got some surprises. Just to give you an example, what happens when two black holes enter the orbits of each other and fall into each other? This, you know, seems like something that people could have done, put on a computer decades ago. Well, it was only in 2005 that people were actually able to solve it. So, you know, it's a hugely messy nonlinear problem. There's so much still to do.
A huge thanks to Professor Pedro Ferreira. His book, The Perfect Theory, is out now in all good on and offline bookshops and published by Little Brown. You can read all of Ian Sample's articles and explainers around the gravitational waves discovery by going to theguardian.com/science. Science Weekly was produced by me, Jason Phipps. From all of us at the science team here at The Guardian, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.